CFRC listeners, this is Christina Laurie, CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative news reporter. CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st, and you can help CFRC keep our listeners informed on issues that matter with modernized broadcasting equipment and trained team members. Help CFRC hit our $25,000 fundraising goal this year by donating today at cfrc.ca. Good morning. It is 11 a.m. on Friday, December 13th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be covering the recent breakdown of the Wolf Islander 4 and how Islanders are responding, new supportive housing opening on Brock Street, a film studio coming to Kingston's East End in 2025, and more. Last week, the Wolf Islander 4 was taken out of commission when damage to the ship left travelers stranded for over 12 hours, before the boat was moved and the Wolf Islander 3 was taken out of its short-lived retirement. The incident reignited a long-standing conversation on the island about the ongoing lack of reliable ferry service. With the ferry currently running on an 80-minute round-trip schedule, with complaints of frequent service disruptions and delays. Wolf Island resident Virginia Lewis spoke to the challenges the current schedule and unreliability of the ferry presents for islanders.
So for my family, we have three young kids. We have a 2-year-old, a 5-year-old, and an 8-year-old. And my children are involved in different activities, and living on the island right now with our ferry disruption and our ferry service the way that it is, it makes it extremely challenging to go to different activities or even to take my kids to a puppet show. Normally takes about 4 or 5 hours to get there and back, which is really hard. The other thing that's really challenging about the ferry service right now is that it's the only way to get ambulances to and from the island. So it takes a very long time. 2 weeks ago, there was a ferry call and it took 2 hours and 4 minutes to get that ambulance on the island and get that person to the hospital. And I know that in rural places that that's absolutely what can happen, and I completely understand that. However, when you can see the hospital from the island, that makes it really frustrating that you can see it and you're really not that far away, but you can't get to it because the ferry has to transport that makes it really hard.
A town hall was organized for islanders to voice their concerns and explore possible solutions. The last week also saw the formation of a new group, Better Service for Wolf Islanders, dedicated to advocating for improved ferry access to and from the island. Lewis explained some of the different ways in which the issue has both divided and brought the island together.
Since last week, it has been very clear that the community is extremely upset, although also divided. So there's this challenge on the island right now is that the project said that it was going to be X number of dollars. We were going to have these two big, huge docks built in Kingston and on Marysville. We were going to have this electric ferry. We were going to have dual service during peak times. A lot of those things have not been met since the project started 5 years ago. So I think the really challenging part is that they're not meeting the needs and they're not saying what they were going to do. And then last week's giant disruption that left people stranded for hours and could have left children stranded for hours was a really big eye-opener that this is going to get worse before it gets better. And if we don't all come together, then we're going to be in a bad situation. But again, we are sitting in kind of a little bit of a divided situation because our council is a little bit dysfunctional and they're not really listening to each other and they're not listening to the community and they're not working together, which makes it hard to do anything when there's just constant fighting. And a lot of people on Wolf Island don't want there to be a dual ferry service. They don't want a lot of tourists and people coming here because it changes the island and it makes it challenging to take the ferry. So yeah, I don't understand the point of view of not wanting better service, because I think that it's a very dangerous situation that we're in with our population and the children that live here and the elderly community that lives here. We're in a position where things could get bad pretty quickly. And we don't want to see that happen.
Mayor of South Frontenac and the island's Judy Greenwood Spears spoke to some of the large-scale issues this has caused the island in an interview with CFRC.
It's insufficient. It has impacted us economically, socially, from a safety perspective. We have no ambulance service, and the county actually cited the dual ferries that we're going to have so they could pull our ambulance service. For police to get there, they have to recall the ferry as well, same as the ambulance service. So it's very, very disruptive. And we've even put a pause on what we had planned on a Marysville secondary plan for housing that would have allowed for up to 150 homes to be built, where I have a public school and a separate school, 3 churches, restaurant, hotel. In other words, we're a viable community and we would welcome additional people. However, I can't get the people that I have on and off the island reliably or in a timely fashion. And that doesn't even begin to address the impact on tourism. We're not asking for the world. We never asked for a luxury ferry. We wanted a reliable ferry on a frequent basis so we can continue to contribute to the Ontario economy.
The Ministry of Transportation, MTO, themselves conducted a study in 2011 determining that Wolf Island has a need for dual ferry service. Mayor Greenwood Spears is urging the province to meet this need and improve their communication, both in terms of live updates on ferry status and in discussing the larger issue at hand. When asked for comment from CFRC, the MTO responded simply stating the Wolf Islander 4 remains at the Marysville dock following the damage sustained last week, and that the ministry is still investigating the incident. As for next steps, Mayor Greenwood Spears and Lewis stated that they will continue to advocate for better ferry service and hope to come to a solution with the province.
One of the things is that when you live on Wolf Island, and I mean when you live in a rural community, sometimes you can really focus on complaining about the problems. And there's been a lot of them lately. But what we're trying to do is come together. We all know that what brings us together, all of us, because everybody has a different life, everybody has their views and everything. Every person is different, every family is different. But what brings us together is our ferry. And what brings us together is this land that we live on, which is an island. So if we can meet at that point that we need to have good service, we all live on an island, then how are we going to get solutions? So what kind of solutions can we come up with as a community that could help MTO solve this problem and us to get what we need as a community, you know, as a prosperous, vibrant community? We need some things. And how can we make it so that MTO can still save face in this challenging situation? Because I think that's what the most important thing is. We can point fingers and we can say all these things, but at the end of the day, how are we all going to move forward? And I think the most important thing is to find common ground and see if there are some solutions. There's not going to be one solution. There's going to be multiple solutions. But how can we use those ideas that we have and share that with MTO and share that with the government and see if we can kind of meet in the middle.
Local production company Branded to Film is almost ready to embark on a $20 million studio project in Kingston's East End. Major productions often pass through to get shots of the city, with visitors including Murdoch Mysteries and Crimson Peak. However, Branded to Film is looking to help the city take a step towards becoming a hub for Canadian film production, with a full-fledged modern studio. In the past 2 years, Branded to Film has already made a significant impact on Kingston's film sector, shooting 2 full productions locally with a majority local crew. They are now leading the charge to build the infrastructure needed for a sustainable, homegrown industry, with Jason Jolly, founder and CEO of Branded to Film, spearheading the studio project. In an interview with CFRC, Jolly dove into where the project started and where Kingston's film industry could be headed.
I kind of realized that Kingston has all of the right ingredients, from location diversity to talent to, you know, young people looking to build careers in the creative industries. And just even the, you know, the cost of land and the fact that Kingston actually had a film office. It's the only film office between Toronto, Montreal, and Ottawa. So, you know, but what I couldn't figure out is, you know, why it was still kind of what I call a place where producers from Toronto just came and spent like 5 days to shoot our limestone, rather than a producer actually setting up shop and shooting what I call like hyper-local films, where they're like end-to-end productions where you develop, pre-produce, and produce films here. And that's really where the story began. Is so in 2022, we started the company. We were really lucky to have some really really influential cultural and business leaders, including, you know, our first two investors were Paul and Gord from The Hip, and who really saw the same vision we did, which was, can we build this new creative sector, which is film and television? And, you know, as a lot of folks may or may not know, is film is, by its nature, production is a very diversified skill set. Like, we have jobs for everybody. So if you're into acting, if you're into catering, if you're into wardrobe, carpentry, transport, whatever, we have a role for you on a film set. So that's what makes it an exciting industry. And what was interesting about Kingston is they really had this kind of, you know, with Megan at Tourism Kingston, she really had a vision not only to create the film office, but also this, how do we turn this into a viable, sustainable sector?
You gave some background on, you know, how the film industry has grown over all these years. How will this studio bring us to the next level?
Well, what a studio represents, it's two things. It's one, there's, you know, a studio at its core is just a big black box. But it's one of those necessary things. Like if you look at our world, especially we're in a very much a streaming world, is where most people consume that kind of long form content. We're very much a series kind of world now. Like, sure, we have lots of feature films and stuff like this, but the most people, and, you know, the biggest part of our industry that's grown is really in that kind of series, capacity. As you can tell by the number of series that drop all the times that people, you know, binge and all that kind of stuff. So where a studio is really helpful is to kind of get to that next level. So yes, of course, we'll, you know, you can shoot, you know, we're going to have, you know, all the things we need to do what's called virtual production. So green screen, you know, LED wall, all that kind of stuff that's very, modern style of filmmaking, with also a traditional element in one of the stages where you can still, build traditional sets. But where a studio really helps is really to scale the business. So apart from what I do now, which is shooting most of, the two films we've done, we shot all on location. This enables us to move to a place where we can start attracting series work. And series, yes, they shoot on location, especially, when you see a pilot of a series, it's all like real locations. But in terms of a continuity going season to season, what you really want to do is those key sets, you really want to have a studio to build those so they're attainable. Like if I have a toucan, I can't expect that the toucan is going to be available every day that I need it for the next, not just this season, but season two and season three. So the thing that you normally do is you would, why a series is important. I know this is a very long-winded answer, but it enables you to move from just simple independent film to larger series, in lack of a better word, which are, ongoing, recurring, and that's when you really see an industry grow. And, when we look at a place like Kingston, Kingston is kind of a magic place. It's very uniquely positioned. 35% of Canadians live within 2.5 hours of here. It's a big little city. It's a city that's at an inflection point. I like to call it the Austin of Canada. It's got a very strong music base, but, on top of that, we've got an incredible nighttime economy. Obviously, we have really great schools like Queen's and St. Lawrence and stuff there. And just the ability that, if you want, you can go to Toronto, Montreal, or in Ottawa, and it's, 5.5 hours to Manhattan, which is all really interesting things to grow. What I think will be, in 10 years, the way we forecast and model our business could be a $100 million business here.
The studio has received support from local businesses and influential figures, with the first two investors being Paul Langlois and Gord Downey from The Tragically Hip. With the project now being 75% financed, Jolly is hopeful they will be able to announce when they're putting shovels in the ground at the upcoming 25th anniversary of the Kingston Canadian Film Festival. 10 acres of land have already been secured for the project, about 8 minutes from downtown and 2 minutes from the 401. Jolly has hopes the studio can play a key role in fostering the next generation of filmmakers and creative professionals in Kingston.
And, if you talk to all of our original seed investors, a lot of them were just like, how do we keep our kids here? How do we bring our kids back? How do we give them a creative industry, which is something we don't have here? So we don't hemorrhage, our youth and those kind of, assets to the big city. I was one of those kids back in the day that, and my question was, how do we make sure that Jay Jolly, no matter who she is, can stay in Kingston if she wants to and pursue her career in film or television or whatever kind of, parallel kind of creative pursuits.
243 Brock Street is officially ready to welcome residents, following the donation of the building by Kingston Health Sciences Center, KHSC, to Lionheart's supportive housing program. Since the Kingston Youth Shelter, originally located at 243 Brock Street, moved in 2021, KHSC has been searching for an organization to take on the space with the same mission of helping those most vulnerable in the community. Lionhearts provides various services with the goal of eradicating hunger and homelessness in the region. After months of preparation, 7 units have been renovated and are being provided at a below market cost, with rent subsidized by the city and additional assistance provided by Lionhearts. Through warming centers, shelters, and transitional housing combined, Lionhearts shelters and houses over 500 individuals a week across Kingston. Not counting the new units at Brock Street, Lionhearts currently has 30 individuals in their supportive housing program, with a goal of increasing that number to 50 in 2025. CEO of Lionhearts, Travis Blackmore, discussed the reopening of 243 Brock Street with CFRC. "I believe Lionhearts has a target of 50 individuals for your supportive housing in 2025. Where do these additional units put you?"
Well, additional units put us down the pathway to our goal, that's for sure, which makes us very excited. I think all of us can look around and see just how big the need is. And you can only tackle these sometimes one person at a time. In this particular case, this will take 7, and that to us is a tremendous positive move for those 7 individuals, and life-changing, to be quite frank.
Are residents ready to move in? Is there still work to be done on the units? Where are we at there?
We are in the what I would say final minutes of the third period, and there won't be overtime. So we're literally ready to cross the line. I think we'll have people ready to move into that residence by the end of December, which is tremendous news for this time of year in the holidays. You know, what kind of a amazing Christmas gift is that for these seven individuals? So I can't tell you how grateful we are to be able to partner with KHSC to pull this off, you know.
In addition to housing, residents will also be supported by the various programs provided by Lionhearts to help them get back on their feet.
Well, of course, there's not just the supports of the building, but there's also the programming that Lionhearts has and encouraging folks to help get them back on their feet towards purpose in life again. I mean, we all survive on purpose, and without purpose, we tend to lack a little bit. So encouraging folks as they put life back together and look at the future and what does that hold for them. That's probably the most exciting piece. It's housing is a step, as everyone is usually aware that housing is a critical step. So you have nutrition, you have housing, and then not far after that, we all need to find some type of purpose, whatever that is, something that's fulfilling for life. So it's exciting for us, our caseworkers, et cetera, to help get folks back on their feet.
Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today, featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Friday, December 13th, staying consistent with that -4, -5 daytime high, dropping down to -7 overnight. Saturday, December 14th, we have a daytime high of -1 with a 40% chance of flurries throughout the day, dropping a single degree to -2 overnight. Sunday, December 15th, ending off the week with a daytime high of 1 degree, so around that freezing mark, and a 60% chance of flurries. And then as we move into the start of next week, Monday, December 16th, we're going to see a high of around 5 degrees, and that will stay consistent into the next day, as Tuesday, December 17th, we have a projected high of 8 degrees. So some unseasonably warm weather after this period of wet and chilly weather. And that's a wrap for your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of Monday, December 9th, 2024. Abbeydon Road, Highway 2 to Middle is closed to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert is closed until December 31st to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Colborne Street, Barrie to Main is closed December 9th from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. for servicing works. Collins Bay Road, CN Rail Crossing to Bath is closed December 9th from 7 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. for the installation of a gas main. Collingwood Street, Earl to Union is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Cooper Street, Albert to Collingwood is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Hillcrest Avenue, Kings Court to 7th is closed for buried infrastructure replacement. The road will be open to local traffic. Kings Court Avenue, Hillcrest to Kirkpatrick is closed to accommodate water main replacement. Union Street, Willingdon to Albert is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. And University Avenue, Union to Earl is closed for construction related to the Queen's J-Duck project. Here are some other delays to keep an eye on. Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl, expect delays and closures along Aberdeen for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles and Edwin to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes phase 2 of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Gardner's Road at Centennial to Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abingdon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abingdon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. And lastly, Sir John A. McDonald at Elmwood. Expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection at Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard and Elmwood Street, including replacement of street lighting, new traffic lights, replacement of asphalt on roadways, and a new multi-use pathway south of the intersection. And that wraps up your City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of December 9th, 2024.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. The Boards of Health for Kingston, Frontenac, and Lennox and Addington Public Health, Hastings Prince Edward Island Public Health, and Leeds, Grenville, and Lanark District Health Unit have unanimously voted to merge and form the Southeast Health Unit. The new health unit will cover a nearly 20,000 square kilometer area and serve more than 550,000 residents. The merging of various local public health agencies throughout Ontario is the first of three pillars of the province's initiative to strengthen public health. The Southeast Health Unit is one of the four merger groups officially forming in Ontario. The province is covering 100% of the costs associated with the mergers. Dr. Peter Oglaza, Kingston's current Medical Officer of Health, will hold the same title for the Southeast Health Unit. Dr. Oglaza discussed the merger with CFRC.
This is a volunteer process, so it took a lot of discussions and even at the very beginning, we were even discussing what's the best configuration. I think that's a really important point because we need to... The ministry set some parameters in terms of what that new entity should look like. So one of the parameters was the size of the new entity should have the catchment area serving approximately 500,000 people. And this is exactly what we meet and slightly exceed for this proposed merger. So it's a sufficient size to increase capacity to provide more surge capacity, provide a good service across the region, but also not too big that it becomes less manageable. I think that's a really good balance between the size and that and all the benefits from the economies of scale that comes from larger entities.
Thank you for speaking to maintaining that balance, because I was also going to ask, this is still a really big region. How will the unique challenges of each community still be accounted for?
But the important point to consider is that the local public health presence will be maintained in the community. So we are under one large organizational umbrella, but the work done through our staff working directly on the ground with the communities, that will continue. Mm-hmm. So if there were public health inspectors visiting local businesses, restaurants in, let's say, the city of Belleville or Hastings County, however they had their area where they were providing services and doing the work. Well, that work will still continue. It will be under the umbrella of the Southeast Health Unit, but the people and that local interaction will staff to community will be will remain the same. And I think that's an important element, is that that local infrastructure through which we provide services in our currently three separate health units will still be in place.
What kind of changes may we start seeing in January 2025?
So I think the main changes that we will see is probably not as visible to the general public. Mm-hmm. Although, yes, there'll be new name, there will be new legal entity. But at the beginning, starting in early January, we'll probably still have three separate websites. So that's going to be a longer process to bring that all together and merge that fully on that user interface. But the governance structure, the board will be new, the name will be new. But in terms of operations, we will take the time to plan it thoughtfully, how to... And then merge the operation between the three organizations, and this is not something we're going to rush, and that is really the intent behind that, is to make sure that local connection and the work and all the advantages of all the strengths of local public health units individually are maintained and brought into that new entity, and then we in addition benefit from that economies of scale aspect, but without compromising that local connection. I think that's really key, and that if there's anything that that I want people to take back from this discussion is that local connection will remain.
The costs associated are being covered by the Ministry of Health. What exactly are the costs associated with this process?
So there's a multi-year budget for year one for our grouping. It's just a little over 10.8 million, and that's a significant figure. But it does include a lot of different items that go towards that budget, and that's something that's the key advantage of this voluntary merger initiative by the province, is that these are significant costs, and there are additional funding that's brought by the province. These are not the costs that municipalities have to bear. So I think that was a very, very significant improvement compared to previous discussions about mergers. Remember, we had a 2019 discussion about the mergers where we had a completely different map, looking at a different number of 10 health units across the province, and some of the boundaries didn't quite make sense based on the local connections that we have in the communities, and there was no additional money for that. So this is a very, very significant departure from that previous concept, and one that's really very much welcomed by us in the field, by our partners.
Dr. Oglaza stated that there will be more front-facing changes in the health system when the other two aspects of the Strengthening Public Health Initiative come into effect: the revision of interior public health standards and the funding formula review. For now, Ontarians should expect the same service or better.
I really hope that this will provide some reassurance to our communities about what this merger will bring, and that they can expect the services will either remain the same or improve. That's the guiding principle behind this merger. And if there's any changes to our services, which there might be some in the future, there will likely be as a result of other two pillars of the Strengthening of Public Health Initiatives. That's where we talk about the Ontario Public Health Standards, which is the element that defines all the work that we do. There might be changes in nature of our work and what we do based on that process. So that's something to keep in mind as well. But as a result of the merger, we don't anticipate significant changes or disruptions. We're planning to make it better. There might be some things that remain the same. We're hoping that a lot of the types or way we do work will be better.
In a report released on Friday, it was revealed that Utilities Kingston is ultimately not recommending the city move forward with the controversial regional biosolids and biogas facility at Knox Farm. The proposed facility was an attempt to move towards non-traditional methods for managing waste. The facility would co-digest sludge from wastewater treatment plants and food waste from the city's green bin program, generating biogas to replace fossil fuels as an energy source. Biosolids produced from the facility would have been used as agricultural fertilizer. The up to $83 million project became an especially hot topic, as community members speculated the facility would be on the council agenda before the year was up. Neighbors of the site and local environmental advocates expressed a multitude of concerns, including the site's proximity to the Little Cataract Way Conservation Area and the impact on the quality of life for those with homes close to the site. A webinar with 62 participants was hosted by 350 Kingston last week, where experts from Queen's University expressed their concerns with the facility. A petition to halt construction garnered 740 signatures. Peter Lawton, who lives in the neighborhood of the proposed site and has been heavily involved in investigating the development, had the following to say on the topic before Friday's announcement.
We're not against innovation, and we're not against this plant, just to be bloody-minded. You know, what we want to know is, okay, how is it going to affect us? You know, tell us about possible leakage. You know, is it going to leak down into the reservoir? How is it going to affect the conservation area that we love? How is it going to affect the animals and birds and the natural resource? And there's no answer. Nobody comes back. Nobody's got an answer. They say, well, we're hoping. We're hoping it won't have any impact. We're hoping it won't have any effect. You know, and I say things like, but if you've got a 24-hour industrial site, that means you're going to have floodlights on 24 hours, you know, which will floodlight the conservation area. Oh, well, we're hoping that won't be necessary. This is the problem. I mean, if they could say definitively, this is what's going to happen with the smells. This is what's going to happen with all the traffic. We're going to, and they say, well, we're going to have to change the traffic patterns coming off the 401 because we're going to have garbage trucks coming in from all over southeastern Ontario. Well, how's that going to affect us? Where is all this traffic going to come from? And if I ask some questions like, well, what about this? What about this? The smells, for example, they say, well, there are government limitations to the amount of smells that we can release, and we will make sure that the plant operates within those limitations. Well, that's just not, it just didn't build that confidence that they really understand what they're doing.
Dr. Darko Matovic, a professor in the Queen's Mechanical Engineering Department, also shared his concerns about the facility with CFRC.
It's probably the worst site you could imagine in Kingston to locate a facility like that, because it is next to conservation area, our beloved Little Cataraqui Conservation Area. Part of that property itself is designated as environmentally sensitive area. Next concern is, and probably the biggest concern, is that you are combining a dirty stream that contains lots of contaminants, including siloxanes, for example, bad ones, that need to be handled somehow, and there are other persistent pollutants called PFAS, like persistent fluorinated pollutants, that are contaminating the waste stream, and you're combining that with a pristine stream from green box, from green bins, that is currently used to create compost that is basically spread on the gardens. With combining these two streams, you create something that is not, would not be allowed to spread anywhere. One of the serious concerns also that I didn't mention is odors. It is well known that many of these facilities suffer from odor problems, and consultants that were being asked that question just simply said, oh, don't worry, we will meet all the standards. That is usually not enough. And although in that corner, it is northwest corner of the intersection of Division Street or / Perth Road and 401, just across 401, there are three hotels that were very concerned, and as you probably know, in Kingston, winds usually blow from west to east or from northwest to southeast. Therefore, the effluents, the odors from that facility would directly affect all the communities across 401. As we say, devil is in the details. The more the process has gone, it was sort of self-propelled and came to the point that the final recommendation was essentially contrary to any attempt to really bring Kingston to a greener future.
When asked if he saw any benefits, Dr. Matovic had this to say.
I see no benefits. In fact, I, as an engineer and as somebody who is working with and teaching some, as a guest teacher, courses in environmental science, I point out to students that the idea that natural gas itself is some kind of intermediary bridge to some greener future is a non-starter. It has been used as an excuse more than as a real goal of greening the agenda or reduction of greenhouse emissions. In reality, and there are papers calling like Bridge to Nowhere, with a clear title showing how misleading the idea that somehow natural gas is going to tide us over to a better, greener future. No, we should be working on phasing out natural gas as soon as possible.
While the facility is not being recommended, it is not due to the issues dominating the public conversation, but instead the overall financial feasibility of the project. Heather Roberts, Director of Water and Wastewater Services with Utilities Kingston, sat down with CFRC directly after the release of the final report. Here is a bit of that conversation. A lot of the conversation has been centered around environmental concerns. Was it exclusively those financial worries that halted this project?
So I think some of the concerns that I've heard about the environment have been around odor and air quality, especially given its location to Little Cat Conservation Area. And, you know, we know as a community that those lands are really important to people. And as a city and as Utilities Kingston, we care about the environment. Every day, my staff are working towards making sure that we provide clean, safe drinking water and that effluent that we return to Lake Ontario from wastewater operations is meets stringent criteria and is of resource quality. So, you know, we absolutely do care about the environment, and looking into this project was about caring for the environment and was about reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But I do understand the report and the types of technologies used that can be lost in it. You know, people can be worried about, you know, okay, we're going to truck all this new waste into the community and it's going to be on a property that isn't developed right now and on a property that is next to conservation lands. And, you know, it's going to be different and it's going to change what that area looks like potentially. And so I do understand what those concerns were and environmental concerns, but and behind the project was to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from operations to do something better for the environment. And so it does mean building a facility, and it does mean that there will be more, that there would have been more truck traffic, and it would have meant that we're taking wastes that are created anyway and turning them into a biogas and upgrading them to a renewable natural gas, meaning that there would be development on a site right now that is in a naturalish kind of state. It is used for a snow management facility. And so I do understand the concerns that are there, the concerns about creating biogas. And some of the details that I read, I think that there were some misconceptions. People were talking about how bad it is to flare gas off into the community. And again, that wasn't the intent. The intent wasn't to take these wastes and create gas and just flare all of those off. The intent was to inject it into the natural gas line and use it as a substitute for fossil fuels.
And is it normal for a project to make it this far before it kind of gets shot down like this?
That's a really good question. And sorry, to just kind of reiterate, it is like, does it make sense that a project would get this far? And I think what's really important is, like, the project isn't that far. The project is still in an investigative state, and we are investigating the feasibility from an environmental and a financial standpoint. In terms of, you know, is this typical for a project not to move forward? Not always. I think that typically there's an intent that you're moving in the right direction. And I think we were moving in the right direction, but for the right reasons around the financial results, we're recommending that this not go forward.
How much money has been spent so far on working on this?
Yeah, so in total for the investigations all the way from master plan to where we are right now, about $1 million.
Roberts also had the following to say regarding the large community response to this project.
I think for this one, again, I think it has to do with the fact that it's on what people would consider undeveloped lands and in an area that's not well developed right now and next door to a conservation area. And so I think another thing about this project is that we did more consultation and more open houses than what was required. And so we knew that people would be interested, and we tried to reach out. So we did definitely notice that we had more engagement. We had more people come out to the public information sessions. We had more engagement from Indigenous communities as well. And we had more people writing into us and providing comments during our public comment period as well, when the environmental study report was first filed. So I think that that's good. I also think, you know, it's really busy times in people's lives and there's a lot to pay attention to. And so we appreciate the ongoing dialogue that people have been having about the project. And I do hope that people take the time to read through the report. I do think the details of what we were proposing are still really important. What we were proposing to do, I will still say, is even though right now financially it doesn't make sense to move forward, and we've studied that and we know that, the idea of taking wastes and producing something off the wastes that can be used as an energy is still a really good idea. And so I do hope that people, you know, take time to learn about what the facility was meant to do and what the intent of the facility was.
In a message directly from the City of Kingston, the Kinsmen Club of Kingston has donated $100,000 in support of the Inclusive Play Project. Over the past year, a significant number of community volunteers have worked tirelessly to raise funds towards the goal of building Kingston's first fully inclusive and accessible playground. The Inclusive Playground was approved by City Council to be built on the site of Shannon Park. With the generous donation from Kinsmen Club of Kingston, the Inclusive Play Project has raised close to $600,000. And continues to work alongside city staff to apply for grants and pursue donations, sponsorships, and naming rights opportunities. The cost of the region's fully inclusive playground is expected to be approximately $1.5 million. In a statement from the Kinsmen Club of Kingston, they state, quote, "Our club believes that every child should be able to experience the joys of childhood. And what greater childhood joy than going to the park? The Inclusive Play Project is an important step toward ensuring that all children in this community will have access to that joy, and we couldn't be happier to help realize that," end quote. More information about supporting the project with corporate sponsorship, in-kind donations, and financial donations can be found on the Inclusive Play Project website. Once again, that was a message directly from the City of Kingston providing an update on the Inclusive Play Project. In another message directly from the city has announced Extend a Family Kingston as the recipient of the 2025 Kingston Community Climate Action Fund for its Growability Hydroponic Greenhouse Project. This initiative aims to address the city's climate action goals while fostering sustainability, inclusivity, and local food security in the community. The Growability Hydroponic Greenhouse Project will upgrade and scale the operations of two hydroponic greenhouses that are capable of producing over 20,000 heads of fresh, locally grown produce each year. Previously, Extend a Family Kingston was a Climate Action Fund participant in 2020 to 2021, installing its first Dunya hydroponic greenhouse unit. By utilizing hydroponic technology, the project will use 90% less water than traditional farming, eliminating the need for soil, avoiding greenhouse gas emissions from transportation, and increasing climate resiliency by sustainably producing local food year-round. The Climate Action Fund fundraising goal for this project is $30,000. Fundraising will take place from December 2024 through March 2025, and 100% of the funds raised will go to the Extend a Family project. Ian Cholmoldley, Extend a Family, Kingston's Program Manager of Innovation, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, states, quote, "Extend a Family Kingston is excited to grow this project through the KCCAF, producing food locally and sustainably to support those in need while increasing the climate resiliency of our community. By supporting Growability, you're not only helping to address food security and environmental goals, but also supporting an inclusive program that enriches lives and strengthens our community." Now in its fifth year, the Climate Action Fund continues to support innovative local initiatives that drive climate action and foster community engagement. Thanks to the partnership with KCCU and the generosity of the Kingston community, 100% of donations will directly support the Growability project. Julie Salter-Kean, Manager of Climate Leadership at the City of Kingston, states, quote, "We're thrilled to work with Extend a Family Kingston once again on this transformative initiative. The Growability Hydroponic Greenhouse Project demonstrates the incredible potential for climate action projects to address environmental challenges, and the positive impact it will have on our community cannot be understated," end quote. Donations can be made at all KCCU branches, where contributions will be matched by up to $5,000, as well as online and at the City of Kingston Payment Center. Tax receipts will be distributed for donations of $20, and the city will match up public donations to $15,000. Join us in supporting this year's KCCF recipient. Together, let's grow a greener Kingston. Once again, that was a message directly from the City of Kingston on this year's Kingston Community Climate Action Fund recipient. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Coming up next for CFRC's afternoon lineup at noon, we have Democracy Now!, syndicated daily global news with Amy Goodman. At 1 p.m., join Corey and Madeline for Close Reads, sharing and analyzing creative writing by students at Queen's. At 1:30, hosted by Samar Kaur, Melodies of Myth is a storytelling radio show blending mini-stories with the rich sounds of Indian classical and Western music. And at 2 p.m., we have Whiplash Anything and Everything with DJ LFN. Stay tuned for all these programs and so much more right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
The Corridor is an award-winning news program hosted by Dinah Jansen and Jesse Bell, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. With contributions from local Journalism Initiative reporters ranging from Morrisburg to Coburg, The Corridor is your premier destination for truly local news that matters to you. The Corridor is also available as a podcast on all major podcast streaming platforms.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Sheep and Wolf's Clothing's latest single, When Echoes Speak, released on November 18th. The track opens with a mechanical winding sound captured from a clicker borrowed from the artist's workplace, which evolves into the rhythmic backbone of the intro. Inspired by the theme song of Rascal Does Not Dream, the bridge section shifts into a more rhythmic, aggressive reimagining. The final 75 seconds feature intricate polymetric layers and different meters with various instruments, building on a foundation of claps, creating a dense, complex timbre. A unique fusion of virtual and live instruments, the song delivers depth in both tone and rhythm. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream When Echoes Speak on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM. Thank you. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Nolan Hubbard's latest single, I Won't Lie, released November 22nd from his second EP and debut release under his new indie label, Kingsville Records. This five-track collection captures the artist's journey through self-discovery and relationships in his early 20s, showing a growth from his 2017 debut, Luminosity. Now 28, Hubbard describes this EP as the culmination of his evolving sound, blending soulful harmony, layered fingerstyle guitar, and genre-bending instrumentation. While rooted in pop folk, the record explores fresh influences like alternative, reggae, hip-hop, and country, balancing creative freedom with a clear pop sensibility. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream I Won't Lie on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I'm doing fine. Got messed up again. Stop seeing all my friends. I was stuck in my head, but the way someone said I look like a mess. Now I know what they meant. Now I just need some rest. Probably meant me the best. Yeah. I've been on stupid long. You don't gotta worry what I'm working on. Those days are gone. Can't hear anybody tell me wrong. I think I just need a break. Put me on a boat in a big old lake. Can't help myself, I'm doing fine. Yeah, I'm feeling good, no, I won't lie. I got the recipe. Wherever I'm cooking is the place to be. Not like obsessively, we'll have a good time on any street. Well, if you wanna ride with me, gotta find time for the comedy. Have the kind of attitude, a little bit of authenticity. Can't help myself.